Hello, welcome to this Wackle Gather podcast. My name's Katie Lee, CEO of Lucky Generals and a proud member of Wackle and chair of Wackle Gather 2020. Wackle stands for Women in Advertising and Communication London and is a networking organisation bringing together the UK's most senior female leaders in marketing, advertising, media and communications. Our purpose is to accelerate gender equality in our industry, and to deliver this we focus on three things: inspiration, support and campaigning. One of the ways we provide inspiration and practical support to aspiring and ambitious women is through Gather, our annual training conference. This year, Gather is a week-long event filled with online keynotes, virtual speed mentoring, and a podcast series. Our theme for the event is Going Further Together, which is becoming more important by the day in every industry. As success is rarely achieved alone, we're taking a look at the ingredients of a high-performing team and what it takes as a leader to build such a team. My guest today is Helen Calcraft, one of the founders of Lucky Generals. Helen is one of British advertising's most high-profile leaders. She has achieved the rare feat of founding two successful agencies, MCBD, the IPA's Effectiveness Agency of the Year in 2005, 2007 and 2010, and Lucky Generals. In 2016, Campaign Magazine named her the number one suit in the business, and Business Insider listed her in the top five most creative people in advertising worldwide. As well as a stellar agency career, she has a great understanding of what makes marketers tick. She has an MBA with distinction from the London Business School and has been a trustee of Cancer Research UK for 4 years. Helen is a proud member and ex-president of Wackle and is currently their representative on a cross-industry initiative, Time 2, to address sexual harassment in advertising. I'm lucky enough to have her as my boss and call her a friend. Hello and welcome, Helen, and thank you for taking the time out to talk to us. Let's open with a few general questions before we get on to our theme for Gather. So the first question for you today: you've had a stellar career, always at agencies in their ascendancy or at their peak. Looking back, who has your most influential boss been on the way up and why?
Hi, Katie, and thank you so much for that very generous introduction. I'm not sure I deserve those kind words, but I certainly do feel lucky to work with you and to call you a colleague and friend as well. So this is very nice, being interviewed by somebody that you know well and that has got your back. So that's lovely. So to your first question, it's so hard because I've had a good number of really incredible bosses. And I was very fortunate to start my career at the agency AMV BBDO and spend 10 years there and then go on and have two agencies. So there are a number of people, but if you had to push me to choose one, I would probably say it was Michael Bourke. Michael was the chief exec of AMV whilst I was growing up, and I was able to see how he really, really delivered an incredible level of momentum, creative highlights and growth in that agency whilst being a thoroughly decent human being. But also it's very difficult because I was so blessed to work with AM and V, all founders of the best agency in London for so many years. And all three of them in different ways, you know, really made an incredible difference to my career. David was the greatest and most brilliant creative I've ever known. Peter, I always described as the Cape Crusader of advertising, in that he always took great care of people and nurtured their entrepreneurial spirit. And Adrian taught me that the devil is in the detail, that you should listen and that you should be highly vigilant towards your clients and your staff colleagues. And so, you know, just so lucky with that combination of people. And I know that's cheating, yeah, but I would say that. And then side notes, I would add Andrew Robertson, the incredible MD of AMV. I would add Jeremy Miles, who was my great friend and mentor, with whom I co-founded MCBD. And more recently, I've gone back for the first time in many years to having a boss, and his name is Troy Ruhannon. And I really, really admire and think the world of him, and I'm still learning. So I guess I've totally cheated and taken something long.
I'd expect nothing less. And what would you say are the best and worst career decisions you've ever made?
It's a tough one. I mean, I think probably the very best career decision I made was to say yes when Jeremy Miles said to me, would you like to start an agency? And I didn't think about it. And I answered within about 4 seconds when he arrived in my little office at AMV with a glass of champagne one evening. And I think that was probably the very best decision because it taught me that actually it's only advertising. It's not that scary. You can do it. You can set up an agency. And of course, that's given me the courage to do it not once, but twice. So I guess that very first entrepreneurial yes was probably the best decision. And it led me to where I am today as a partner of Lucky Generals, where I'm the happiest I've ever been in my career. Worst decisions? Oh, so many bad decisions. I would say one of them is to have not taken more time on my maternity leaves. I think I was one of those terrible people pleasers in a generation of women who were afraid of missing out, of letting people down, of really just not doing the right thing by taking longer with their children to take maternity leave. And it certainly taught me now I'm very, very strongly in favor of women taking a year and longer if they want to, because in the end, our career lives are long, but our time with our little ones is very short. So I would say it's not a regret, but it wasn't the best decision. I mean, I was lucky because I was a partner in my own agency. I was able to be pretty ruthless and selfish with my decisions around leaving early and coming in late and taking days off. But I would say take more time off with your kids when you have them. And I probably would say generally take more time off the bus. So we founded MCBD 1 week after we left AMV. And again, I wish I'd taken 2 or 3 months, because there's a wonderful thing that happens to your brain and your perspective when you actually get off the bus for a little while. I actually think it makes you better at your job, not worse. And I haven't done enough of that, taken sabbaticals, taken time, taken extended holidays. And what that really does is it gives you perspective, creativity, it allows your imagination to flow. And so, yeah, I wish I'd taken a bit more time off in between doing things.
And here's a completely left field one. What was your dream job as a kid and why?
Oh, I always, from the age of about 6, when I first played Alice in a production of Alice in Wonderland at school, at primary school, I always wanted to be an actress. That was the dream that I held on to all the way through to the age of about 21, when I finally finished college. And I had a bit of an epiphany at the end of doing a drama degree and thought, much as I absolutely love, love, love the craft of acting, the life of an actor is incredibly difficult. And I just didn't feel it was the right life for me at that time. And I don't regret that. I'm really happy I made the decision to not do that. But there was a bit of me that harbours a quiet dream that maybe I take up acting at the age of 80 and do what Jessica Tandy did and get my first Oscar.
Yeah, I think that'd be great. And you're inspiring / insane enough to have founded 2 agencies. What learning have you brought with you, and how have you avoided a single style as a founder?
I mean, I think that's quite a difficult question. I am so lucky to have been able to have founded 2 agencies, and it certainly wasn't some part of some career plan. And I think if Danny and Andy hadn't taken me out for lunch, that's Danny Brooke Taylor and Andy Nairn, my partners, and said, do you want to start an agency? I definitely wouldn't have started a second one. This was about working with 2 people I loved and admired and adored, and thinking I couldn't possibly do anything else. So it wasn't a deliberate career plan, but I'm very, very glad I did it. And of course, you learn so much from the act of starting one company, you know, building that company, eventually selling that company, and then starting again. You learn so much from your mistakes, and things that you wish you'd done, or wish things you wish you hadn't done, that you bring forward, which is a great gift at Lucky Generals. And I guess how you avoid a single style as a founder is, you know, you grow. I'm a very different person to the person I was at 31 when I co-founded MCBD. You grow and learn, and hopefully you evolve as a human being. So your style moves and changes, but also the style of an agency is very much, the culture of an agency is very much set by a combination of the founders. And so the combination you're in sets the tone rather than you individually.
And there are very few females at your level in business, and certainly very few females that founded agencies at 31. What do you think is one of the biggest challenges for the generation of women coming up behind us?
I'm really sad to say that I think a lot of the challenges haven't changed, and I wish that we could do more collectively. And I know this is something that vexes many WACL execs and many WACL members, is how do we make it easier for women to actually get to senior positions, and in particular, be in an entrepreneurial position. And I think, you know, one of the biggest challenges is still, how do you balance family and career? And that, by family, I don't just mean having your own children, although that is a very big part of it, but also just being a great daughter, aunt, sister, all of those things. It's very, very difficult, particularly in advertising, because it is so, it takes up so much of your time, but also so much of your emotion. You know, it's a very, very absorbing career, which in some ways makes it wonderful, but in other ways makes it very challenging. And I do think that a lot of women say, listen, I'd love to be MD of an agency, or I'd love to be chief exec or start my own, but I just don't know how I can make that work with being a great mother or family member. And I still don't think collectively that we have a good enough solution for that.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you.
And Katie, I really admire the work you've been doing on this, which is, you know, in large measure, the solution has got to involve men, has got to involve a new and revolutionary attitude to parenthood, not just motherhood. And I think that we really need our really great male colleagues to be in on this debate and conversation, because businesses are certainly better when you've got a good combination of men and women at the top.
Mm. And also leading by example as well, and making sure that the next generation see you going home.
Yes.
See you flying out the door. Yeah.
And see you taking that year's maternity leave, and more importantly, seeing the very senior men not being embarrassed or shy to take paternity leave or to do shared paternity leave. I mean, these things are, these are still taboos that we're having to really address.
And being rewarded while you're on maternity leave, which is something I've always been really impressed with, is the number of people at Lucky Generals that you hired whilst, when they were pregnant, or promoted similarly, so that they understood that this wasn't a barrier to progression.
Absolutely.
Next question. The view of what makes a good leader has changed in recent years, from old-fashioned command and control to a more collaborative and often more vulnerable style of leadership. We often talk about the need to show that vulnerability in order to build trust within teams. How do you as a leader balance that with the expectation that people expect those at the top to have the answers?
I think this is a very complicated and nuanced issue, really, because in the end of the day, you know, great leaders do still lead from the front. And those of us who are now thrust into dealing with the issues that come with COVID-19, we do need to show a level of confidence and a level of sure-footedness when everyone around us is feeling vulnerable and scared. And I think it's no good being too vulnerable that people lose confidence in you. But I think it is about having the courage to say, I don't know, or the courage to apologize when you've made a mistake, or the courage in particular to laugh at yourself and not take yourself too seriously, you know, to make statements and to try to lead, you know, in a way that is confident, but to be prepared to accept that we don't all get it right all the time, and that we do need to accept that, and to show the side of us that doesn't expect us to be, you know, completely without error.
Mm. And I sometimes struggle with the word vulnerable in those situations, because there's an authenticity, which is a great trait for leaders to show. But sometimes, especially, as you say, times like now, vulnerability is not the trait that you want a leader to be exhibiting.
I completely agree, Katie. And for me, I often use the word humanity, because I think, you know, showing your human side is not the same as showing vulnerability.
Yeah, yeah. And we couldn't get through this podcast without talking about COVID, as we are living through just this unprecedented time at the moment. And at times of crisis, we've just said, people do look for strong leadership. How have you approached this through the organisation at this time?
Well, you know the answer to this well, because you and I have been holding hands on a daily basis, Katie, and checking each other and checking that we're not being tone deaf and we're getting things right. And I guess, you know, part of that answer is to surround yourself with people that you really trust, who have a high degree of emotional intelligence, but are able to balance that kindness and humanity with a realism around the commercial side of things. So I think, you know, having people around you to keep you real and to bounce things off is incredibly important. But I guess for me, it's interesting because we lived through the crash of 08, 09. And I think one of the things that it taught me, I mean, we did not handle that terribly well at the time because we just wanted to believe that things would get better quicker than they did. And I think the great learning for me, you know, perhaps a decade or so later, is to say, look, we have to embrace the fact that this is going to be long running and it's going to be difficult. And we have to deliver our news, bad or good, you know, with honesty. And I think what people can't bear is not knowing where they stand and feeling insecure that every time the phone rings, they're going to get drip, drip, drip of bad news. And so, as you know, we decided to act very decisively, but very clearly, and say to people, look, this is how we as a company are handling the next 3 months. This is what we are doing. This is what we're asking from you. And this is how it's going to be. Because the greatest challenge in difficult times is when people, you know, who work in an organization feel afraid, unsure, and they worried about their job as opposed to doing their job. And I think the job of really good leaders is to take away that anxiety. And one of the ways you do that is to deliver the bad news in a transparent and, you know, decisive way. And I think people respect that more than if you try and game it or you try and sugar the pill and then they find out down the road that things were much worse than they'd been led to believe. I think it's much better to have those tough conversations early and fully. Mm.
And I think what we also did well was balancing that moral and commercial requirement as well, making sure that we delivered the bad news and we delivered it quickly, but we also made sure that we were looking after all of the people as individuals.
Yes, definitely.
As part of developing the theme and content for this year's Gather event, we took inspiration from Google's Project Aristotle, which was conducted in collaboration with MIT, Union College and Carnegie Mellon. The project took 3 years, surveyed 180 teams and evaluated over 250 variables, which revealed the 5 secret ingredients that drive high-performing teams. The first of this, which is psychological safety, where team members feel safe to take risks and be vulnerable in front of each other. The second, dependability, where team members get things done on time and meet a high bar for excellence. The third, structure and clarity, where the team has clear roles, plans and goals. The fourth is meaning, where work was personally important to the team members and it varied from person to person. For some, it was providing for the family, yet to others, it might be the challenge of the tasks. And finally, it's impact, where team members think their work matters and creates change. So we're not going to talk through all of these, Helen, but I thought we might look at a couple of these and just get your thinking about this idea of high performance teams. And the first one we were going to talk about was psychological safety. Mm-hmm. It would be lovely to hear from you about your definition of psychological safety. The term could imply everything's going to feel safe and cozy, but actually there's way more to that in the way we should be looking at it, isn't there?
Yes, and I think that psychological safety is at the core of what really helps creative companies deliver creatively. I think you cannot come up with brave, original, innovative and exciting ideas unless you are in an environment where you feel safe. And this is the whole process of creativity, really. So psychological safety is at the heart of creative brilliance. You cannot have people feeling as though they will be judged or they might lose their jobs if they push themselves into the realms of innovation and originality. So for me, psychological safety is, within the creative agency context, is working in a company where if you come up with an idea that doesn't fly, that you're not going to be punished, that you won't be, you know, punished in an internal meeting, or you won't be punished if that idea makes it to market and doesn't quite connect with consumers. And I think you just have to feel that you're working in an environment where there is a preparedness to fail. Mm-hmm. And that for me is at the core of psychological safety, which is there will not be judgment. There will be support and there will be an understanding that if you fail, you failed through good intentions. And that for me is what psychological safety is all about, and it allows for original creative thinking.
Yeah, failed with everyone behind you the whole way through it.
Yeah,
absolutely. And then looking into dependability, I guess especially when you're a founder of an agency and therefore everyone that you are working with, you are relying on so much more almost than if you're just doing your day job. But if there are things are slipping, how do you engender that shared sense of dependability? How do you encourage teams to set the bar high for themselves, or almost as high as, you know, as a founder?
And again, I think I probably learned a lot about this from, you know, leaving a large and successful agency to founding an agency to founding a second agency. And I think, you know, one of the things that I've learned in my leadership style is actually one of the greatest way that you can achieve having dependable people around you is to trust them, is to hand over that trust, to not necessarily be too maternal or paternal, but actually say to them, I trust you, and I'm not going to, you know, literally keep my eyes on everything you're doing and saying and sort of, you know, have my arms around you all the time, but I'm going to trust you to do something. And what I found, you know, to my great pleasure in the latter part of my career is the more you take the first move to give trust to highly motivated people, the more dependable they become.
Yeah, I love that. It's really interesting. So looking at meaning and impact, you've already talked about how a role in an advertising agency, when you work in advertising, how all-encompassing it can be. What have you learned and what advice would you give about how to help people find meaning and impact in their job if it's not readily apparent to them? And do you think that with the right approach, any job can be meaningful?
I think that there is a great deal of meaning to be found in doing a job that you enjoy, doing a job that helps you feel as though you are making a difference to the company that you work in. And for many people, I also think there's meaning in a sense of progress and being able to feel as though you are learning and that you're being stretched as a person as you go to work on a year-by-year basis. But I, as I've got older and sort of longer in the tooth, I do increasingly think that meaning in a job comes so much from working in a company whose values you agree with and a culture where you feel you belong. And I think belonging and working in a company that you feel has got the best interests of their staff and of their customers at heart makes a huge difference to people. And I think there's no greater example than, you know, obviously one of our major clients is the Co-op, but also Amazon at this time. You know, there are people working in companies where they feel, I'm doing my small part in COVID. I might be delivering those packages and leaving them outside the door and putting my health at risk every day. Or I might be, you know, serving very, very anxious, afraid customers as they come in to buy their weekly groceries. But I'm part of something bigger that is doing something meaningful. And I think that makes a huge difference to people is to be part of a company whose values that they ascribe to. And then increasingly, I do think the culture of companies helps people find meaning and impact. If you go to work and you think, you know, my views are going to be listened to and I'm important to this company, whatever my role is, and I feel as though I fit in with this culture and I can contribute to this culture, that makes a huge difference. And certainly in Lucky Generals, we have an incredibly strong culture, but we have a culture where everybody feels as though they have an ownership in it. They have an opinion, they have a voice, they have a role to play to grow that culture. And I think there's huge meaning and impact to be found in finding a company that's got a good culture and a cultural fit with you and being part of it.
And finally, Helen, I want to say a huge thank you for doing this today. I really, really appreciate it. And want to give you the chance to turn the tables. Helen, if you could pick any living woman to interview, who'd you pick and why?
Gosh, I should have thought about this before you asked me the question. I guess I've got my quick answer would be everybody's, which would be Michelle Obama. I would just adore to meet her. But I think really, and that would be across my life, and I would never not want to meet her and sit down with her and talk to her about becoming and about her whole career and her ethos, which I think she's an incredible woman. But if I could interview anyone tomorrow morning, if you said, Helen, here's a microphone, off you go, I would have to say Jacinda Ardern, because she's just doing the most phenomenal job in the toughest of times. And, you know, as a female leader, showing us, you know, her humanity, her leadership skills, her ability to bring everyone with her in a conversation, her ability to have great clarity and great courage, but also, you know, a massive amount of humanity in there as well. And I think she is a blueprint for the future, and I would adore to talk to her right now about what we could all learn from the way she's doing things in New Zealand.
Line up behind my two children who've said that they wish she was our Prime Minister at the moment. So
join the club, exactly.
They're only 7 and 11 and they get it.
Yeah.
But Helen, thank you so much for this. Really, really appreciate it.
I hope I've said something that might be news to you, Katie, because we talk every day. I'm sure it was a bit boring to ask me these questions, but it was lovely to chat to you too.
Looking forward to it.
I'd also just love to end by saying, you know, I just think WACL is the most extraordinary club. I feel so proud and honoured to be a member and ex-president. And I think, you know, this club is going through an extraordinary time. And thank you and the rest of the exec committee and our fantastic president for everything you're doing in these difficult times for the women of WACL too.